super consequential, super important in the life of Moshe Rabbeinu, but also, of course, in the life of the Jewish people who are led by Moshe Rabbeinu, and in the model of Moshe Rabbeinu. So much to talk about, so we'll see how much we can cover in the time that we have. But just to get started, so the Aliyah begins. This is Perek Beis, Pasuk Yud Aleph, the third Aliyah of Shmos. Vayihi b'yamim ahem, vayigdal Moshe, vayetzel echad. Vayar b'sivlosam, vayar yish mitzri, make yish ivri, me'echad. Already in that one Pasuk, there are so many different things being conveyed. So first off, vayigdal Moshe. So Moshe grew up. So that's good to know. Moshe got bigger. As Rashi notes, we already told this, that Vayigdal Hayeled, that the young man had grown up. So why we have this repeated here? So he suggests different intentions, different messages that previously we were told in terms of age, that he got older. And here we're talking about Gedula, that he ascended to greatness, that Paro had appointed him in charge of his household. It seems also that a part of the message, a big part of the message, and it's one of the recurring themes in Parsha Shmos, and it's a part of how Kadosh Baruch Hu reveals himself to Moshe, and it's a part of what is going to be embedded in our identity throughout Sefer Shmos, is the ability to feel the pain and the suffering of others and to have that recognition and appreciation. And the fact that the pasuk continues, we'll say more about this, the pasuk goes on to say that Moshe saw their suffering. It's easy to imagine that that's the continuation here of this idea that Vayigdal Moshe, and he saw their suffering, that Moshe grew not only chronologically, not only physically, not only in his stature society-wise, but he grew in his sensitivity, and he grew in his perspective, and in greatness, that one is greater for having a broader sensitivity and awareness and a perspective of the needs of others. So these two phrases presumably go hand in hand, that Moshe was greater in that he was able to be aware and to perceive and to care about the suffering of others. So here, this is related also to a point that the Aznayim L'Torah writes over here, that the godless that's being referred to, writes the Litzkarav, the Aznayim L'Torah, that he was able to leave his place of luxury to go help those who were suffering. And Ad Kedei Kach, as we're going to see very soon, that he's going to be hunted, he's going to be targeted for execution by Paro, by the very one who had raised him. So maybe there's a little bit of irony here, that's a part of it. He doesn't spell this out exactly as Naim Atar, but it sounds like that's what he's getting at, that he was great, and Vayigdal, and the one who raised him, who made him Gadol in the more basic sense, is ironically the one who's going to be looking to kill him because of the actual greatness that he possesses. The Ramban has a comment here that the pasuk is trying to tell us that in terms of his overall maturity, his physical maturity, that he grew unnaturally quickly, and that he suggests that that's what Chazal read in the pasuk, because the language of Vayihi b'yamim ahem, that the pasuk is coming to convey that language, usually it means that this is a immediate continuation of what was happening right before. But if he really aged so much since then, so then it's later. So the fact that the pasuk could be conveying both at the same time, that it was within that previous time frame, and also that he grew up, says the Ramban, that's coming to tell us that his aging was perhaps more than natural. His maturing really was perhaps more than natural, and he grew up very quickly. Now, how old was he? So there are different midrashim, different views in Chazal, how old exactly he was. According to some opinions, he was 20. According to some, he was 40. And according to some, he wasn't 20, and that's going to play a role in some interpretations here. It's possible he was only 12, which is particularly interesting to say. He wasn't even what we call bar mitzvah yet, and he's still being referred to as a gadol here. That's particularly interesting. So what does he do? So he goes out to his brothers. And who are his brothers? And what's he doing going out to them? So the Abrat Benel writes that this is presumably a reference to the Jewish people. They're his brothers. He also suggests it could mean some more specific literal brothers, maybe the Levim, or maybe we're actually talking about literal brothers from parents or cousins. But he went out to see among them, and he writes there because he was told that he was Jewish, and therefore he had a desire to see what was happening to the Jews. And different Mefarshim have different understandings, whether he was told specifically that he was Jewish or it had become known that he was adopted from among the Jewish people. But whether it's this way or that way, apparently he came to learn that he himself was Jewish and therefore felt a desire to go out and see what was happening with the Jews themselves. And the Malbim emphasizes here that you see this shows his greatness, that even when he was brought up in such wealth and such luxury and he came from his Jewish roots and was adopted into this household, he doesn't lose sight of that connection now that he knows about it, and he doesn't see himself as separate from them, but rather he wants to emphasize the connection to them. And this is itself a sign of godliness. We know that it's often a criticism that is leveled against people who have become wealthy, who come from more humble origins, and then they become very rich, that sometimes they forget about where they came from and they don't care about the people who they left behind. So for Moshe to be raised in such luxury and to then be told you're Jewish, and that makes him want to care more about the Jewish people. So that's also an indication of his godliness. And again, it's consistent with what we said before, that there's a relationship between Vayigdal Moshe and Vayetze Elochav and Vayabis Ablosim. This is all of one piece. This is all a representation of this godliness that the Pasuk is referring to. So maybe parenthetically, the Ben Ezra suggests there could be a different meaning here to Echav, that maybe if we're working off the premise he's still an adopted Egyptian, that's the focus. So then maybe it means his Egyptian brothers, he went to check up on them, and then you'd have to say that Bayar B'Sivlo Som means that he saw the suffering that they were imposing, not that they were undergoing, but that they were imposing on others. And that was what he went out to check on. So that might be an interpretation based on some other indications in the text. But as we see, many of the Mefarshim assume that it's talking about his Jewish brothers and that he cared and saw about their suffering. And that's the focus here. And that is very, very crucial. So this notion of Vayar B'Sivlo Som is highly significant. And here it's worth even just looking at the phrase that Rashi has here. Vayar b'sivlo son, nasan einav v'libo lios meitzer aleihem. That he placed his attention, he put his eyes and his heart to worry about them. So what we have here is active empathy. Right? That he is choosing this language of nasan einav, that this is a deliberate act, that he is choosing to pay attention to what's going on with them and to care actively. And there's a lot written about the role of empathy, both constructively and maybe sometimes less so. There's been a lot written recently about whether, on the one hand, is empathy the only real reliable path to bring one to action? Is that the main driver to make people care and to act compassionately because they themselves are troubled by suffering, because they feel empathy and they see the suffering and they feel it themselves, so they're moved to act? And if so, do we need to specifically cultivate empathy and teach empathy in order to make sure that kindness will happen, that society will improve, because those who care are driven to do so because of their identification with the suffering? Is that the only path? Is that the most effective path? Could that sometimes take you down the wrong path? There's a lot that has been written about that in recent years and in recent decades, but here it's very striking to see this language that Moshe is moved to act, and he is, seems like he is putting himself in that position deliberately, that he is looking to become empathetic towards them. He's looking to see what is happening to them, and through that to take up action on their behalf. And Rav David Tzvi Hoffman notes that the pasuk says "Vayar" twice. Vayar b'tzivlosam, Vayar yishmitzri maki shivri me'achav. So the idea that he saw it twice, he suggests that that's also reflective of this idea that he was looking, and through this looking, he developed more rachmanis, and that increased, and that moved him more. And indeed, that was the result, that he was more involved in trying to take action to protect them because of his paying attention and because of his watching the suffering. Znayim Mutara. Again, the Litzgrav, he has a lot to say about everything, but a lot to say about these psukim as well. So he notes here that Vayar really should be understood as understanding, that it means that he understood their suffering. He points to the pasuk in the first parak of Koheles, V'libi ra havre chachma, that it refers to seeing through your heart, to understanding and to really grasping. And that's, again, consistent with this idea that because he was paying attention to their suffering, he understood what it was, and he realized what was happening. So, again, he's moved to act. So it says, me'achav. So what does that mean, the fact that he was hitting a ish ivri me'achav? So according to this one medrash, it means that he was Ben Levi, the person who was being hit. There's Naim Latorah comments on that, that he thinks that that is a difficult interpretation, because then it's implying that this empathy and sympathy that we were just describing about Moshe was only triggered by the fact that he was a Levi. It was because there was this close relationship. So that was what was able, that was what was successful in getting him to act. It doesn't sound like it. It was not in the Torah notes. Probably not a necessary part of the story that it had to be a Ben Levi. And there's another medrash that this was Dasan, who we will hear about soon, who was from Reuven, which brings up its own issues. So he suggests one possibility. There's a lot that's written in the Karashi and other sources about the whole background of the story. But one suggestion that he has there, the Litzgarov, is that he, me'achav, means that this was happening. The person who was being hit was among his brethren at the time, that basically this Mitzri grabbed this Jewish man, and there were Jews surrounding him, and he was hitting him in front of all these witnesses. And the witnesses weren't doing anything to stop it. They were not raising up any kind of resistance. And that was because they were already used to it, they were already downtrodden, and they were already accustomed to such treatment of slaves. But Moshe Rabbeinu, he wasn't used to it. He was not jaded and already accustomed to this kind of treatment. So he steps up and he acts. He also, the Zayim Torah suggests a different interpretation. Says that maybe the emphasis here is Me'achav, that he was one of Moshe's brothers, meaning that he was Jewish just like Moshe. And the point being that you would think that maybe the Mitzri should be afraid of this, because here, if Moshe is both Jewish and connected, he's from the household of the king, so then maybe that's a reason he should have been inhibited. He should have thought that Moshe is going to get angry about this and Moshe is going to turn him in. But we see that Dmitri was not afraid of that, because that was the nature of the politics of the time, that Paro is more interested in having Jews beat up than he's going to care about what Moshe wants, or he's going to care about his sensitivities. And Mitzri knew this and was not inhibited, and maybe that's what the pasuk is coming to suggest. So in any event, this is what Moshe sees. So Vayifen kol b'chol v'yar k'enish v'yachas ha-mitzri v'yitmenei b'chol. So here is a lot that's very fascinating. So he looks around and he sees that there isn't anybody. V'yar k'enish. So that may come to emphasize a certain midah of Moshe, that yes, he was passionate, and yes, he was motivated to act on behalf of justice, but he also wasn't reckless. He also wasn't going to be unaware of what potential dangers could be around. And that's something that Rav Shem Shmuel Hirsch emphasizes in his commentary, where he also notes that you see here that Moshe was not looking to be perceived as a hero, and that's something that's going to crop up again as the parsha goes on. You see that he is resistant to the call to leadership, that he wasn't looking for glory, and he certainly was not reckless and unconcerned about the fact that maybe he's going to be seen. There are other interpretations in a very different sense. The Rogatchover, in the Sefer Tzafnas Paneach, so he writes here that he saw that he himself, that Moshe, was not an adult. We mentioned a few minutes ago the whole question of how old was he? Was he 40 or was he 20 or was he less than 20? So if the idea is he was even younger than that, so maybe he was not in a position to really be a dayan here of dinei nefashos, of taking his own initiative in terms of issuing capital punishment. And that actually is a whole question here. And the truth is, you look at this forum, so there's a lot of back and forth about trying to figure out exactly what are the details and what were the issues that were relevant. That this idea that Moshe kills the Mitzri, so did he kill him outright? And was he justified in killing him outright? Was the Mitzri Chayiv Misa? So there are a little bit of mixed impressions that we get here. So the Gemara, Maseches Sanhedrin, and Daftan Chasim Beis, it sounds like the Gemara is assuming that this Mitzri was indeed Chayiv Misa, and the Gemara understands it from the Pasuk, from what happened, that what Moshe did seems to indicate that he was Chayiv Misa. However, there's various questions that could be raised. The Torah Tamim understands that Gemara as an Asmachta. We just mentioned a minute ago that the Rogatchover understood that even if he was Chayiv Misa, Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't in a position to be done dinei nefashos. And many raise the question that Rashi quotes the idea that Vayar Ki Einish, that suggests that it's not a literal interpretation, that Moshe Rabbeinu, before taking action, he looked into the future and he saw Einish, there's nobody who's going to come from this individual, that there wasn't going to be any future offspring who would have been this guy or who would have converted, that he would have to worry about. So this is very hard to understand on so many levels, but many of the Sfarim raise the question that that's not usually a standard that makes a difference when it comes to a Chiyuv Misa. It's one of the major issues, actually, now there's so much discussion about abortion, which is also one of the major subjects in this week's Parsha, really from the early as a lot of the halachically oriented Parsha Sfarim talk about abortion, talk about it in this week's Parsha, mostly because of the first Aliyah. But one of the Gemaras, it's difficult on the topic of abortion, the Gemara in Erchin says that a woman is Chayiv Misa, so we would execute her even if she's pregnant. So it doesn't seem to be a cheshbon. So if this man was really Chayiv Misa, so the idea that Moshe should look into future generations and should calculate whether or not he should execute him based on would there be any descendant anywhere down the line, that would be Maguire. So it's very difficult. So to address that question, many of the Sfarim suggest that that itself indicates that this was not a straight Chiyuv Misa, normal Mrs. Besdin kind of scenario. That the Gemara is saying that on some level it was a Roy Lahargo, and Moshe Rabbeinu may or may not have been in a position to take this action. There's a drush about this in the Sefer Bar Yosef, where he also tries to work through some of the details here, and among other suggestions, he notes that it could be that he was looking at the situation within Rodef, that it wasn't necessarily that this Mitzri was Chayiv Misa as an Onesh, but maybe there was a need to stop him from going further than that. Maybe he intuited that the Mitzri was trying to kill the Jew. And then the question becomes, okay, but how can you stop the Radifa in the minimally aggressive way? So it's a complicated cheshbon. So there's a lot to try to figure out about what was going on here. And together with all of these complications and these fake ghosts, so it could be, and this is something that Bar Yosef suggests, that that might be why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't kill him b'yadayim. That is what the indication is. Rashi tells us later that Moshe killed him b'shem ha-mefarish. That Moshe killed him actually with the shem Hashem. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, but the pasuk does say that he hit him. Right? It sounds like he did kill him b'yadayim. The Ragged Shaver has a comment here also that he notes, he quotes from a couple of Gemaras. I think I mentioned a few weeks ago we were talking about Tzafnas Panech when it appeared in the Parsha. Now, it's a little ironic because that phrase means the revealer of secrets, and the Ragged Shaver called, Sefer called Tzafnas Panech is one of the most mysterious Svarim. So you have to really know all the Gemaras that he's talking about. So we have the Ragged Shaver al Torah, there's the footnotes that fill in all the Gemaras, all the references. Mentioned the time that Sefer was originally published by Yeshiva University through the efforts of Rav Teitz and others, but in the Tzafnas Panech al Torah, so you have the footnotes that fill in all the Gemaras that he's alluding to, where he notes that you see in Shas that the interpretation of the language of Bayach when somebody hits a person, that it means short of killing them, that he didn't actually kill him. So then he buried him. He hid him in the sand, not as a kfura of a person who was dead. That was a part of basically an indirect kind of misa. So apparently he used the shem ha-mefarish, he hid him without killing him, and he buried him in the sand before he was dead, but there wasn't a direct execution here. So take all these parts together, however you assess them. So does that make Moshe a murderer? It's a good question, because the Chassam Sofer, in his commentaries on the Torah, commentary on the Torah to Parshas Truma, said commentaries, actually does have a lot of commentaries, a lot of different editions of the Torah's Moshe. Sometimes it's called the Chassam Sofer on the Torah, sometimes it's called the Torah's Moshe, and it came out in many different editions. There actually are a number of different versions of the commentary of the Chassam Sofer on the Torah, but in one of the editions of the Chassam Sofer on the Torah, so he writes that the reason Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't be the Kohen Gadol is because he killed the Mitzri. And we know we find the halacha in the context of Birchas Kohenim, that Kohen Shaharegas HaNefesh Lo Yutzas Kapov, a Kohen who has killed someone, so he should not dochen. And there's a lot of discussion there about, does that mean only an unjustified murder? Or maybe it means even less than that. Maybe it means a furthest extreme. Maybe even would include somebody who kills another person justifiably in self-defense or in the defense of others. So it could be that even if it was totally justified, it was even called for, that maybe it would still disqualify a Kohen. Why should that be? It doesn't sound fair if he does the right thing. So we know that David HaMelech was excluded from building the Beis HaMikdash because of the people he killed. And even though we assume also that David HaMelech killed justifiably in war, still there is a conflict between having killed maybe even in those kind of circumstances and being able to build the Beis HaMikdash, maybe being able to do Berachos Kohanim, to engage in the activities of Kahuna. requires a peaceful soul, and that even if there was justified killing, maybe that would still get in the way. So there's a lot of debate about that in Poskim, about whether this exclusion of a killer, does it mean specifically an unjustified murder, or maybe it means, you know, at the opposite extreme, maybe a very justified killer, maybe would it apply to somebody who was in the Israeli army and who killed people in war or in other armies. There's a lot of literature about that, and there's a lot of cases in between. What about somebody who wasn't justified but wasn't a murderer either? Maybe it was negligent, it was accidental. There's a lot of discussion about that. And so connected to this, the fact that the Chasam Sofer associates Moshe Rabbeinu with that category because of this incident is an interesting part of the discussion. You could also connect to this that if we assume that, like Rashi says, that he killed him with the Shem HaMefarish, so that opens up another level of questioning. Would a Kohen who killed somebody b'Shem HaMefarish, would he be excluded from Berachas Kohanim? What if he killed without using his physical hands? So there is a whole discussion in the Poskim, a little bit of discussion about that too, but there's also a discussion a little bit more common in day-to-day life, unfortunately, that there might be Kohanim who embarrass people in public. And the Gemara says in a few places in Shas that a Malbim Pnei Chaveru Barabim is considered to be Ki'ilu Shafach Damim, that there is some comparison between embarrassing people and murder. So there are some poskim who raise the issue, should we say that a Kohen who embarrasses people in public, should he also be excluded from Berachas Kohanim? The tshuva about that, Rav Osner has in the tshuva Shevet Alevi, and Rav Nosson Gishtetner in the tshuva Slaharis Nosson. A number of others far talk about that. So in the Shevet Alevi and the Slaharis Nosson, they both come out that they don't think such a person would be excluded from Berachas Kohanim, that maybe we don't assume that the connection is literal, that Malbim Pnei Chaveru Barabim is not a literal murderer, but also, as the Laharis Nosson notes, that he thought that even if it was really equated to murder, but the language, the Gemara in Brachos, says the Kohen Shaharig is a nefesh le'isas kapav, is based on a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Yideichem Damim Maleu, I think so the pasuk goes. So it suggests that it's specifically, you have bloody hands, specifically a physical murder. If one were to commit murder not in a physical means, then maybe it wouldn't be included. So it's also perhaps relevant to that discussion. So if it was done in a non-physical fashion, would that maybe affect this whole story? Zach, you have a question?
Well, wouldn't the embarrassment still be a disqualification, because doesn't the Kohen have to be beloved by the people who he is blessing?
That's a very good question. So we do find that issue of beloved as a requirement, and it's consistent with this whole idea. It's in the spirit of the same kind of consideration. So unfortunately, sometimes we see nowadays that people can act in a disrespectful way and can humiliate others and can still be beloved. So maybe it's because people have become used to that and have accepted that as behavior. But I think you're right that ideally that they should be incompatible. And it shouldn't be that somebody who embarrasses people would be perceived as beloved, and it should theoretically trigger that concern. That's a very good point. Okay, so in any event, so then the pasuk goes on to move to the next story. Again, there's so much going on in this aliyah. Every pasuk contains whole chapters. So v'yetze b'yom hasheni v'hinei shnei anoshim ivrim nitzim. So much in this pasuk. So he goes out and he sees these two Jews who are fighting. So who are the two Jews fighting? So this language of Nitzin. So the Gemara Maseches Nedarim and Daf Samach Daled Amud Beis, the Gemara says that whenever you see language like that, Nitzin, so that always means things like this, these people who are quarreling, who are fighting, that's always Dasan and Abiram. So the Torah Tamima has a comment over there. He says, why does the Gemara have to tell us this? What's the significance of such a drasha? It's because of an attitude the Gemara has. Actually, the Gemara a couple of times in Bava Basra, and he makes a reference to a Gemara actually in our parak in Bava Basra, which hopefully we'll get to, but also the Gemara later in Bava Basra, where you have the sentiment expressed that Tola Kalkala B'Makukal, that if we have to try to figure out where is the bad behavior coming from, so we should assume that it's probably connected to those who are already known for bad behavior. And he discusses that's true about a lot of things, and this is even true about inanimate objects, even true in halacha, that you find that the problems in kashrut and other areas should be assumed initially to associate with where there's been previous problems, and that is the message the Gemara is attaching here by bringing up this point. I think you could also say that it's really saying something about Bali Machlokas, which is itself an issue with us and the Aviram, and it's something which comes up again and again itself, that people who are troublemakers, it's not just a discrete Maisa, it's a Mida, and that's an attribute that needs to be addressed as an attribute, and not just as an action that stands in and of itself. But that people who have this midah of causing machlokas and of starting fights wherever they go. So this is something that indeed crops up again and again. And maybe that's what the Gemara is emphasizing, that you have troublemakers. So they are troublemakers by teva. They are people who will return to that behavior again and again. And that's thus in an aviram as representational of that. And that's the kind of midah that has to be addressed as a midah. And we have to recognize that that's something which brings up a lot of concern and a lot of continuing impact on society if it's not recognized and addressed. Okay, so what does he say? It says, Vayoma la Rasha, Lama Saka Reacha. So he says to the Rasha, he says, why are you going to hit your friend? So here there is a very often quoted comment of the Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Ches in the Beis that says that somebody who is Meirim Yad L'Chavero, somebody who lifts his hand in violence against somebody else, is called a Rasha, because we have to figure out, how does he know who the Rasha is? And it says he saw two people fighting and he addressed the Rasha. So who's the Rasha? The Rasha was the one who had lifted up his hand in a violent gesture. So the Gemara says that you see from here that there is an Isser of Haramas Yad, that just lifting up your hand in a violent gesture, that itself is an Isser, separate and apart from the Isser of hitting someone. Hitting someone is its own prohibitions derived from the pasuk Leosif and Tosif Hakoso, that even when justifiably giving malchus, you can't go past 40, because any one additional hit is going to be an isser. So kavod v'chomer when there's no justification to begin with. So we have already an isser of hitting people. So what we're talking about here is something separate and apart from that. Varen Soloveitchik had an essay about this in one of the svarim that was printed at his shiurim. That you see there is a discrete isser here, there's a separate isser, there's the isser of hitting people, the isser of Haramas Yad is something different. And you have to try to understand what exactly is the nature of this isser. So especially if it's different from hitting and you haven't actually hit the other guy, so why should there be an isser just to lift your hand? Some suggest that maybe it's like a chatzi shir, that it's like a little bit of an isser without actually getting to the whole standard threshold of the isser itself. It's a little bit hard to say because here you're not actually even making contact. Some suggest that maybe it's because of the pachad that you instill in the other person, that that's what the isser is about, which has an element to it as well, for sure. We spoke a little bit yesterday, right, about the whole idea that hezekriya may reflect the fact that you are imposing some kind of inhibition and pachad on somebody else. And maybe there's a related theme here. There are those who suggest that it's a siag, that it's a concern that one may come to actually make contact and therefore we have a separate prohibition even to start the process. These are all possibilities. I thought what the pshat here was, and it's very striking to note, no pun intended, that there is a great status that comes from here, that the idea of the person is called a rasha. So it was a machlokes whether this would extend even to psul eidus. And the Ramah writes that indeed there is a psul eidus, that somebody who would violate the sister of her Hermas Yad is psul eidus midrabanan. And all of that is quite impressive, that there would be an isser, that it would be an isser that would label the individual as a rasha, and that it would have such significance actually to disqualify him from eidus. So I thought that really the pshat here was that you have two people who are arguing. So, okay, they're arguing. So they're yelling. That's what people do. But once somebody even lifts his hand up, so then he has changed the whole nature of the discourse. All the rules of engagement are no longer the same. That this is no longer just a argument between people that remains within the confines of normal civil interaction, but this could turn violent. And whether or not it actually turns violent is a separate question, but just the idea that it could, and that's now acceptable, this is now something that's conceivable, that it could turn violent. So that is something which does tremendous damage to society and redefines one's whole nature. One is no longer seen the same way if he is willing even to think about changing this whole method of interaction from a peaceful, albeit heated, argument to a actual fight with violence. So that says something about the person who is looking to do that, and it also says something about his compatibility with civil society, which is a part of the considerations as far as eidus is concerned. So the idea that he would be possible to eidus to even a level of the rabbanan for that kind of behavior maybe is something we could understand. And I don't want to get political in either direction here, but remember last year Parashat Shmos was when the riot happened in the Capitol, and reflected at the time that the whole notion of riots anywhere, wherever they happen, is a major affront against society, because the whole notion of expressing the grievances in violence and in vandalism is one that is highly problematic and changes the whole level of interaction. But especially in the context of the Capitol building, where the Senate meets, and the Senate is known as a great deliberative body, at the seat of our democracy, where we can find intense disagreement, but it should happen in a civil fashion. It should happen through words. It should happen through debate and not through physical violence. So the whole notion of introducing that kind of an atmosphere specifically into that kind of a setting does a tremendous harm to our society, changes the whole way in which we think, in which we feel like we are ready to behave, and that does tremendous damage. And that's one of the major messages that is emerging from this parsha, the many, many major messages emerging from this parsha. He also emphasizes when he says this to this individual, Rambam LaRasha, Lama Sakeh, so he speaks to the Rosh, says, why will you hit? And Lama Sakeh Re'echa. So here the Torah Tamina has a comment also that the emphasis on Re'echa is relevant as well. Torah Tamina notes that even to the extent that one could assume that there might be a heter to hit somebody, that let's say if a person who one is hitting is himself a rasha and poses some kind of a harm and needs to be corrected through physical corporal punishment, so that could only be administered by somebody who is himself righteous and is doing that l'shem shamayim. But if the person doing the hitting is himself a rasha, so then his hitting is never going to be justified. His hitting is going to be just as problematic as any other kind of hitting. So especially because we've already established that the two players here are Dustin and Aviram, with their own history, both of them, of querulousness and of troublemaking and squabbling, even in the physical sense. So therefore, it's not going to be justified no matter what, that even if the hitee was deserving of being hit, if the hitter is himself a rasha, so then that's going to erase any kind of permission. And the Sefer Yabinyam, and he quotes from Chaim Kanievsky, you know, he thought that was true about Lashon Hara as well, that when you find that there might be a dispensation for Lashon Hara about someone because of their personal status, so that's not going to apply if the speaker himself shares the same issues, and that's also a part of the message here. So here, the next pasuk, which I think is probably the time as far as we're going to get, so much in this, we'll have to continue part two on Sunday, but this next pasuk tells us, V'yomer mi samcha l'ish, sar v'shalfeit aleinu, halahargenu ata omer, kashaharakt es ha-mitzri, v'ira moshe v'yomar achinu da-adab. So they said, who made you a judge on us? Who put you on top of us? You're going to kill us too? And Moshe perceived what was going on here, and he was concerned, he was afraid, he was scared, and he said, "Achein no dahadaver." He says, "I see the matter has become known." So Rishwab has a comment here, which is interesting because you see that it's differing in its assumptions from what the other mafreshim that we've mentioned so far were assuming about some of the background here. But Rishwab poses the question, which certainly a compelling question, that they ask him, who made you a judge? Who put you in charge? Well, they know he's coming from the palace, right? They know he's coming from the king's household. So it's actually pretty credible that he would have some kind of authority, that somebody would have put him in charge of them. So the idea that they are so confident that he doesn't have any kind of superiority over them is interesting. And he suggests, Rishwab, that out of their tremendous hatred, it's interesting, as Naim Latorah notes that you see here also, it's me that we actually was, I think Rosham Shnafal Hirsch actually has a comment like this, so it was Schwab's predecessor in the Breuer's community, that the first one of the community, that Hirsch had noted that you see here that these mitzvahs, they were already imposing themselves on the Jews, and the Jews were so subjugated that they would take whatever was being dished out by the Egyptians. But when a Jew starts to try to impose some order on them, they rebel. They're not going to take it from another Jew. They're not going to be able to tolerate that. So here, Schwab is writing that they hated him so much, and they were able to kind of pierce into his whole history. And they realized, which apparently his assumption was, it wasn't clear, that he was not a pure Egyptian, but that he was actually Jewish and brought into the palace from there. And that scared Moshe, because Moshe was afraid that that would cause him to be revealed. So that was where his pachad came from, that he realized that from this comment, they must have understood that he was actually himself a Jew. But Rashi also has a comment here, a very important comment, that you see here, Achein Odah Hadavar. So what does Rashi write? That first, kamashmo, it just means literally that the word has gotten out. And then he writes, midrasho, no deli adagar shiisi tamalav. So I see now the matter that I was wondering about. Ma chata Yisrael may call shivim umos lios nirdim babaytis parach. What was the Jews do so terrible that they should be enslaved in such a fashion with such backbreaking labor? Abareyani shehem ru'im lakach. I see that they deserve it. And the Midrash and the Rashi quotes, so it's more explicit, that we see that they are dilatorim, that they are balei lashon hara, that apparently they are willing to speak badly about others and to engage in machlokas. And that's why they deserve to be in galus. So here, there's a lot that's very fascinating about this. In the Sefer Leib Avraham, Avraham Weinfeld, so he notes that keep in mind, this is the same Moshe Rabbeinu who defended the Jewish people throughout. And yet, here he's saying, oh, they are Bali Machlokas, they are Bali Lashon Hara, and therefore, they're worthy of being enslaved. You can't expect them to be redeemed. So apparently, this is so much worse than everything else that happens. It's worse than the Egel Azav, it's worse than all their other problems. So presumably, the issue is that, yeah, that makes them irredeemable, that if they're going to be such troublemakers and they're not going to have any sense of achdus, so then we're not going to be able to lift them up from their current state, and that's going to be a fundamental problem that's going to stand in the way of everything. But I think it also goes to the issue of the Lashon Hara assessment, and to the idea that he says that they're Bali Lashon Hara, and that's the Avera. So it's interesting to think about that from the perspective of trying to understand what Lashon Hara is really about. That if the point is that just that they reported to others what happened, that Moshe killed the Mitzri, so one might think, well, you know, that's not so surprising. I would expect that to be reported. I would think that that's something that people should talk about, because we know that Lashon Hara is permitted when it's the Toelis, when it's to warn people about problems. So if Moshe was killing people who he was upset at, so I would imagine that's something that is understandable if people would talk about that, if people would relate to that. So the notion that he's so surprised that this was discussed at all, maybe that itself is surprising. Except we understand that when it comes to Lashon Hara, so Lashon Hara is not just about reporting facts. It's not just about saying such and such happened. But it's about the assessment, and it's about the interpretation. And that's really the thrust of the Issur Lashon Hara. That's really what drives a lot of the problems that are behind Lashon Hara, and a lot of the reason why there is an Issur involved. So here, yes, it's true, okay, Moshe killed the Mitzri, but you really think that therefore he wants to kill all the Jews? He was doing this in defense, that here this Mitzri was hitting the vulnerable Jewish person, and Moshe stepped up to defend, he stepped up to protect, and other Jews see this, especially if we say, according to the Medrash that I mentioned before, that the Hitti in that case was himself Dasan, right? So then you really have to think about how does that work? And because if that was Dasan, and here this fight is Dasan and Aviram, so Achein Odo HaDavar, they speak Lashon Hara, so, well, of course he knew about it, and he was a part of that whole story. But if we understand it this way, then it's not about relating the facts, but it's how you interpret it. So how do you read what Moshe was doing, that he was indeed looking to be a protector and a savior to the Jewish people? Or no, he's just a violent guy who tends to go ballistic when he's upset about something. So for them to see it that way, for them to see it the second way, so that's Lashon Hara in the sense of the interpretation, and it's a Bali Machlokes Mida in the sense of how they assess and how they relate to what was happening. So that kind of Mida is going to be a big problem, and we're going to see, indeed, it's going to crop up, that for Moshe to try to help these people and try to guide them to redemption,